Hey, good morning, everybody. Let's just call the meeting to order. Thank you all for being here. We have a few new board members, so I thought maybe we could just go down the line here and each person introduce yourself and state your area of expertise. We'll start with Bill.
I'm Bill Chapman. I think I know everybody. My area of expertise, I guess, is architectural history for purposes of the board.
My name is Graham Hart. I'm a new board member. I'm a licensed architect, and I lecture at the university, and have been on other boards in kind of architectural history and preservation assets.
So architecture.
Architecture. That's my area of expertise.
Kay Stevens, board chair in architecture.
Otonoki Naka, sociology.
Nick Caluzzo. I'm not new, but this is my second meeting, so near new, and archaeology.
Ralph Cam, I teach historic preservation at the university.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, new and newish board members. Okay, our first agenda item is the approval of the meeting minutes from Friday, November 18th. Does anybody have any edits or for those of you who are here for that meeting? Okay, seeing none, I have a motion to approve.
I move we accept.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Second, thank you. Minutes approved. I need to back up and the agenda. Need to approve the agenda. I moved on to the minutes too quickly. Does anybody have any suggested changes for the agenda? Okay. Hearing none, a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Thank you, Bill.
Second.
Thank you, Alton. Okay, agenda and minutes approved. Okay, our nominations today, our first one will be the work at Chop City House.
Good morning. I did not do this nomination. It was done by heart. As a matter of fact, Stanley is here just coincidentally today, and he's the one who actually wrote the nomination. That's why it's so thorough. Wolfat is already on the National Register. It's not on the State Register. It's on the National Register as part of the Chinatown Historic District. The nomination that's before you is to individually list it on both the Hawaii Register and the National Register. Just some background. The building is in the process of being rehabilitated. The owners have already done an environmental assessment and received a FONSI, finding of no adverse effect. They've also gone through the Chinatown permitting process and before the Chinatown Design Review Committee, and that's all been approved by them as well. They've also applied for a Tax Act credit with the National Park Service. The part one of that application is an indication of is it individually listed, and the Park Service has already approved that it is, that it meets the criteria. The part two is what they're going to do, and they're still negotiating with the Park Service on one or two items. But they're moving along with that. Also, they're already working on the building because they've been phasing the project. They already had building permits for the demolition of the interior, which has been done. They've also gotten a permit to do exterior restoration of the building, renovation, and they're right now in the process of getting the permit for the interior construction. And at this point, Dean tells me that the only thing that they're waiting on is the Board of Water Supplies. That should be coming too. So that's where it is right now in the process. The building was built in 1938, opened up then. The architect was Yuk Tong Char, who was local architect. He, I want to find out more about him. Stanley found out more than I ever knew. But he was born in Waipahu in 1890. He goes to Mills Institute, which is now part of Mid-Pacific, graduates from Mills, and somehow he ends up going to Cornell. And in 1915, he gets his degree in architecture. And at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, but I think Cornell was one of the more prestigious architectural schools in the nation.
It was and is, yeah.
Yeah. And so I find it very impressive that somebody born in Waipahu ends up graduating from Cornell in 1915. He then comes back and he works in Hawaii. He works for a number of years with several architectural firms, Guy Rothwell, and also Herbert Caton Cohn. And then finally in 1930, he goes out on his own and starts his own business. WOFAT is probably one of the best known buildings. Other buildings that still stand, Alton and Hilo, the Chinese Christian church, he did that, which has a flared roof. And he also did the parsonage on top for that building. Other buildings that he did, which are no longer in existence, I don't know if you remember the Korean Christian church up on Liliha Street. That's been demolished and rebuilt, but he did do that. He also did the Chinese language school down in Chinatown, actually, in the area behind Chinatown, but that's also been demolished. So he was doing a lot of that. I know he's done some, I've run across his name on a couple of building permits for houses, but I haven't really tracked it close. So he was the architect of the building. And but just like the building in Hilo or the language school, he did a lot of the major buildings in what I call a Chinese American style of architecture, where he's integrating Western and Chinese influences in the building, the Chinese mainly being decorative elements. The building is located in the middle of Chinatown at Hotel Street and Mauna Kea Street. This is the Eva Mackay Corner. We're nominating at the local level under Criterion A for its associations with the trade and commerce in Hawaii as an early example of a successful Chinese American enterprise. And the WOFAT originally was started by a man named Wat Jing King, G-I-N-G, Jing. And he opened it as a bakery, and he emigrated to Hawaii in 1883. Stanley saw references that started before he got here, which seems dubious. So we suspect that the business started in 1883 or right shortly thereafter. In 1886, his bakery was destroyed in a Chinatown fire of that year. He rebuilt on Mauna Kea Street, and again, a fire destroyed that building in 1900, in the big fire of that year. He again rebuilt it. I think at that time it was not quite where this building is. It says Mauna Kea near Hotel, or rather the other way, Hotel near Mauna Kea. But then in 19, the company was incorporated and became the name changed to WOFAT in the 1890s, and then it was incorporated, and after it was incorporated, they decided to build a new building and a restaurant, which was also, by the 1900s, was a restaurant as well as a bakery. And then they built the building that's there today. I forget the year it went out of business, 2000-something, and so it was the oldest Chinese chop suey house in Hawaii at the time of its closing. After that, it became a nightclub for several years, and then it became vacant and was at least rumored to be a gambling den. So that was the building. It's also being registered under Criterion C as a good example of a commercial building built in Honolulu during the 30s in a Chinese American style of architecture. And the building's typical of its period is design, materials, craftsmanship, and methods of construction. And this is what the building looks like today. It's under wraps, getting ready. Well, it's already got the demolition started on the interior and getting ready to start doing the interior work. So here's what it looked like before it got wrapped up. Actually, not immediately, the windows are now gone. But the building is essentially a three-story building. Has ornate Chinese flared roof to green tiles. It has bracketing underneath the roof line. The third story was added in the 60s and is not a very aesthetically compatible addition. And at the first story, you still have your different bays, and the second floor also. The new owners are going to convert the building into a hotel and restaurant on the ground floor. It's going to be a restaurant and a bar, and also a coffee shop. And upstairs on the second and third floors is going to be used for a boutique hotel. The owners are busy at work. They're intending to restore the transoms that are missing. Originally, in these spaces, there were casement windows with brick rack, and they're going to replace that with fixed windows like here now, but you will have the patterns of the original in the windows. Also up here, they've been working with the Park Service. They've already removed this addition, and they're going to be putting a new third story in, which is a little more compatible. They'll be having casement windows, which will be, in, again, a Chinese sort of style. And so they're doing that as well. The sign, which is now illegal in Chinatown, is going to be getting an exemption. They've already got a new sign fabricated, which will also replicate the build the sign and have neon operatives again in the sign. So that's pretty. Here's a picture of the building before that addition was put on. And you see, there was a pavilion up here, which will remain. Well, it'll be built out again, just like from the 60s. And here you can see a view of the interior, all the painted work up on. This is all concrete, which is painted. And the owners hope to do some restoration and preservation of that. Next. Here's a picture, a little closer up. You can see the transoms still have the rick rack in here. These are have been replaced in a number of cases. Other ones have been very deteriorated. Also, there's still some original transoms, which also will be replicated where they're missing. Here you can see they're at work already, working on the downstairs transoms. Okay, I talked about the sign already. And when the this is the second floor, what was the main dining hall. When it became a nightclub, they painted the entire place black. The owners are in the process now of trying to remove the black paint and take it back. Next. There is some spots up above the drop ceiling, some places are saved, so we can still see what the original paint was. He's still there. Next. Here's a close-up of one of those. And now here's what's today. They've started to remove all the black paint, and they intend to be restoring and bringing these all back. Next. Here, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, the last slide, you can see up here, even the ceiling had some paintings on it, so they found that when they started taking it apart. Okay, and so they've been taking the paint off the ceilings as well. And here's a view of a column. As I mentioned, here's an aerial view. Here's the original pavilion part. This tower is vertical circulation, was an elevator. And so they've removed all of this, and then they'll be replacing it with a new addition there, which it'll be a little bit higher. They've been negotiating with the Park Service exactly on the height, so the Park Service has been working very closely with them on that. Okay. And here you can see today, before it was wrapped up, they've opened it up, taken off the addition already. And here's what the interior looked like before this was the addition, which had been moved. You can see upstairs it had painted ceilings too. They're trying to figure out if they can save this or not, because I don't know, it's a different kind of paint in it, so not as not as good condition. Next. And here's a view of that as well. Okay. Then in the turret, in the front turret, there's this very nice mural on the ceiling, which was never painted over, fortunately. And they'll be saving this as well. It's hard to read, I guess, but dragging in the sky. Next. And here you can see today that they're starting to do their work. Okay? And that's essentially the building as it is. I have a couple slides of the proposed renovation if you want to see it. And I can show you that. This one is just the site. Next. Here you can see what's going to be on the ground floor. You're going to have what used to be the entry, the side entry off Hotel Street, went up to the second floor to the restaurant. You're going to make that into a lobby area. And then they're going to have a restaurant here and a coffee shop. And this will have a big bar inside too. And we're not sure. Oh, here's the coffee bar. This is Montefiore Street here. This is Hotel. So this is the lobby inside. Lobby. What is this? This must be all back of the house. And then here's the restaurant area. And I don't know if they're still working on it. I know they're working with the camp. You can actually walk up and get coffee from the street. So they're trying to do it. Next. Here's the second floor. You come off the elevator, and then I forget how, I think there's a total of 20 something rooms, so it must be around 10 rooms on this floor. They'll be keeping the concrete columns and beams exposed, so they'll be there and they'll be inside the rooms as well. And next floor, then on the third floor, here's the footprint of where the pavilion was, and then they'll popping that out also, so there's hotel rooms up there as well. So that's the plan. So if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Tom, you said they had applied for, they received the demo permit for the interior, and they applied for the architecture, the construction permit for the interior. Did you say something about the exterior?
Yes, permit? They got the permit for that already.
Exterior, great. Okay, anybody have questions for Don? Anybody in the audience?
Compliment Stanley for a very nice nomination. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Don, thanks for the presentation. I think it'll be a wonderful asset for Chinatown. I hope it's a catalyst in really taking a chance on this, right?
I think so, yeah. It's a very small hotel. And it was interesting when we did the EA, the city required bicycle parking, not only in the front for public, but also it had to provide space in the back for staff. And so I thought that was very interesting. There's a little alley that runs down the Hotel Street side, and they were able to put bicycle parking in there. It would be secure.
Stanley, did you come across the reference, and from here to eternity? And for them, they always say, let's go down to Wopat and get a meal.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
It's there, so you, I think you could find a,
okay,
a searchable PDF version of it.
No idea what I have. I actually, the Cardiac more expanded the nomination on certain topics because I had kind of narrowed it down to just focus more on the building and the business within it and the impact on culinary arts here in Honolulu. And also the, because it was a building that was built by Japanese and Chinese during a very difficult time, the war began in China. It was just, I was trying to focus on those aspects. but you could go on forever because everybody's got a Wolfpack story.
Well, it would be great to have it back again.
Absolutely. And I'm going to make one more comment. I will thank Hart for, at the time, you know, allowing me to assist the developer in the preparation of the structural preservation certification application for the front end. So it's parts one and two.
Okay, anybody like to make a motion?
I'll move that we put it on the historic register on the criteria A and C and recommend it for the federal.
Okay, would you like to second?
Second.
Do we recommend it to the national, it's already on, right?
Yeah, it's on as part of a district, but they would like it to be on individually, so.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, any other comments, questions? Okay, let's take a vote. All in favor, please send us on the state register.
Aye.
Consideration.
Aye.
Was that everybody? Did you, yes, unanimous.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Don, Stanley. Next property is Halal Market.
Morning. My name is Nancy Nishikawa. I'm with Jacobs. We are the general engineering consultant for Hart. And I will be doing the presentation for Halal Market. I'm a planner, relying on the information in the nomination that was also prepared by Stanley with assistance from Hardy Heckmore. So I will I say anything wrong or if there needs elaboration. I'm very fortunate that Stanley is here today. And so the Halal Market nomination is very similar to Wolfat in terms of it being a nomination at the local level. So the architect, Hegel Piccino and Issei, architect of prominence at the time. The style, Art Deco, this photograph shows a very, clearly cultural style, and the contractor, Nakichi Goto and the Aloha Building Company, also a Japanese American. The location of the property is on Kekalipi Street, 930. So here's Nimitz Highway, Kekalipi Street. And it's right on the corner. You can see it a little bit better in this photograph here, Nimitz Highway, Kekalipi Street, King Street. Here's Halal Market. And this area here is the site of the future Chinatown rail station. So Hart acquired this property, part of the Halal Market property for station construction. This had been the parking that was attached to Halal Market. With the loss of that parking area, the owners of Halal Market said that they weren't able to run their facility or have full economic use of their facility and requested that Hart purchase the entire building, the entire parcel, which is why the site is now in city jurisdiction. It's owned by the city. So a couple of older maps. So the Halal Market was constructed in 1936. These maps from 1891 and 1914. You can see the existing buildings. So the site had been occupied by other buildings in the past. From opening day in 1936, a brand new building. And again, here it is in 1950. 1981, you can see it fully operating as a marketplace. And a current photograph that the Hola Market sign has been replaced by a smaller sign, Chinatown Marketplace, but otherwise the front facade is largely untouched. This is from the slide, so you can see this is that open area that will be the future rail station. Again, the open area for rail construction. So the nomination is being put forward under both criterion A, and it's the building is part of the commercial area, integrated as a marketplace, similar to the Oahu Marketplace nearby. What makes it distinct was that the owners from the very beginning promoted Hawaiian food vendors and allowed Hawaiian culinary traditions to flourish at a time when many of the businesses in the area focused on immigrant cultures and traditions. And then also criteria C, both for its being an example of that Art Deco style of the period, and then featuring the work of architect Hago Puccino. In terms of integrity, many of the characteristics still exist. The changes that have been made are considered minimal and don't detract from the building's historic character and integrity. I kind of like this information where you can see from the second anniversary sale, for example, butter was 2 pounds for 59 cents, lemons, a penny each. So that's where the big changes are. And again, Hula Market.
Okay, any questions for Nancy? Do you know if the, is this currently on the register as part of the Chinatown district?
The nomination form shows that it is on the National Register. So that's what our architectural consultants have found.
And they would like this to be put on individually on the state register, also considered for national?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Is the plan to use it as a market again? Is that the?
Oh, I should say right now the building is being used temporarily to store, for temporary storage. So Hart has been storing basalt curbs that were removed from Dillingham Boulevard. So until they're reused when the streets are reconstructed, it's being stored there. Hart did put some work into the building to stabilize it, to make some immediate critical repairs so that it's structurally safe.
So you don't know what it'll be used for once the station's done?
No plans yet, but the plan is to reuse and repurpose that.
Uh-huh.
Will the original sign be restored under the new plans?
Oh, that would be a great idea for to restore that building. I think it was very distinctive from the original construction.
Yeah. As with the meat and vegetable Art Deco signs, they were nice too.
I've already asked Stanley, and he didn't know, but why 1914 on the building? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know.
A detail that everyone missed.
No, Ralph didn't, I guess.
Right above Hola.
Yeah, you're right.
That was 1936.
It's like
it says 1936 in the slide.
It was an address.
I mean, in Fort Street Mall, there's a couple buildings there that used to be owned by the Catholic Church, and then they were sold and they were purchased again, and that one has a date reflected of I think the establishment of the Catholic Church rather than the construction date.
The arrival of the sisters.
So it could be reflective of like some something associated with the owner, like when they started the business or something like that, or when they came.
But on the slide it says 1936 is the beginning of the period of significance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I thought it said 1936.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, likely.
I think it's a stylized tree.
The Lum Yip-Key building has a 1968 on its facade, and it's, I think, 1903 as the actual building.
Mm-hmm. So it could just be reflective of another date, which would be common throughout, you know, like Honolulu specifically. So.
Yes.
But for our purposes, it's 36, correct?
Right. I mean, even in Chinatown, certain persons like Yim Kwan who fell out of favor with the elite of the community, they erased his memory and any records it had, so there's always that tendency.
Yeah.
Has the front awning been removed as well?
Most of it has, yes. All of the structural members that are still visible.
Hmm.
So everything, but the interesting thing about Hegel Fujima's drawings, I found them in an index at UH, and I sent one of our contract historians to go, and they have all the dimensions for all the lettering on the canopy.
Hmm.
So it can be duplicated.
Perfect.
And sections as well.
I know years ago we talked to Hart about possibly repurposing this as like a bike locker storage pickup.
That's the one next to it.
Oh, okay.
I go. It's the brick building. The painted white. Everybody thinks it's a lot younger than what it really is. Because you go around where the flash has been taken away from it.
Mm-hmm.
It's basalt and it's brick. What they did was it's a remnant of an older building. They took down between three and four courses on the parapet and sidewalls, so the brick starts lower on, and they, on the missing courses, they added ceiling. That's the one on the left hand side.
Well, happy to make a motion.
Yes, please.
I move that we let the property allow Market be listed on the State Register of Historic Places under criteria A and C, and that it also be recommended for listing in the National Register under the same criteria.
Okay.
Happy to second it.
Thank you, Rob. Okay. Any further discussion? Questions? All in favor of placing this on the State Register, recommend to National?
Aye.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Unanimous? Thank you. Thank you. The next property is a bookkeeper's house.
We can actually list
this. Sister Stanley?
I'm going to stay here, if that's all right.
No worries.
Thank you. responsible for Winter Community Housing in the chapter was built on the future in 1945. The owners of the property purchased it in 2021, and at the time that they purchased it, it was being marketed as a potential building site, which seems to be fairly consistent with a lot of Front Street properties, and had the Milligans not purchased it, it probably would have been demolished. The Milligans come from, not from Dutchburg, that's Newport. They come from...
New Bedford, it says.
West, I know it's an error, and I got corrected this morning early, when I didn't get time to change it. They're from Westport, Massachusetts. And they produce award-winning restorations of NRHP listed and eligible properties, including the Frederick Allen House, Bob, which was totally burned out. You can see below, it's a classic I house. And it was built initially in 1709, and then in 1835, and then they most recently renovated it in 2017. And then the Callan Spooner House, which originally dates to 1806, and both of those are located in New Bedford with National Historical Park. So they're dedicated to preservation, and I don't know why they're going after the 20th century building, but anyway, next slide. This dwelling was reserved for the bookkeeper of the Pamco subsidiary, the Ice Company, or LICO, and sited next to an adjacent dwelling at 281 Front Street that was nearly identical in plan and detailing, but was not occupied by the Pamco company or the Pamco bookkeeper. The bookkeeper's house is among 13 dwellings that were relocated from other tenants or built new from mid-level managers. As for example, manager Caleb Burns erected his house at Mount Buddha in 1924 that was known in the vernacular as Puomana. And everybody refers to it today still as Puomana. The house that we're looking at today is marked with a red arrow. The far right arrow, which is shown as C, that's Caleb Burns' house. All PMCO and LICO bookkeepers appear to have worked in the PMCO office, which was built in 1910, and this nomination provides an opportunity to gain insights into the lives of an otherwise overlooked cohort of PMCO employees. It should be noted that most of the assistant bookkeepers and clerks did not live on Front Street, but in houses on the Heinemann Road or elsewhere. The number of bookkeepers who resided in this dwelling included Frank A. Almeida, Hugo K. Bruce, and William Van Patty. The most notable of these and the first resident was Frank and Lily. And the dwelling has associations with Frank A. Almeida Armory in Waikuku that was built in 1937 and was the Hawaii National Guard headquarters for the 1st Battalion, 299th Infantry. The top photos on the left-hand side, I just found that research on the PMCO bookkeeper's house. There are other bookkeepers, and the Freudenberg family have posted these two photographs on Ancestry.com. And the top photo was taken probably after the office initially opened in 1910, and it probably includes Bruce Little Hattie Freudenberg. Freudenberg is on the far right. The bottom photograph is Freudenberg's on a stool next to what was known as a stand-up desk. And this is a typical accoutrement for a bookkeeper in corporate America. Next slide, please. The PMCO, like the bookkeeper's house, is a craftsman-inspired plantation of vernacular dwelling and a rare example of an H-plan house. There are only four H-plan houses. Photograph, I think, dates to 2010, and it shows 281, which has got the arrow next to it, that's the house we're looking at, and the bookkeeper's house is 271 Front Street on the left. Next slide, please. this was a pandemic project, so the floor plan that you have in the nomination actually was from the initial nomination that was prepared and submitted in 2021 and then withdrawn. So that is before or pre-rehab. So that's going to be on your left, and the post-rehab is on the right. On the left-hand side, we've got rooms 103, 100, which is an extension of a corridor, 102. And these are from the 1960s addition, which was tacked on to the house. And those rooms supported a second floor of 9. For the next slide, the 1960s addition, 102, 103, and part of 100 was removed in the rehabilitation. The door was added to a corridor in 100. Airboard bound doors were added to the original garage in 101. The window was removed in 101 and added in 103. And the floor columns were added to support a new lanai. Original exterior and materials were restored throughout. Next slide, please. This is for the second floor. Pre and post rehab floor plans effectively. Again, during the 1960s, the lanai was built on the roof of the first floor addition. A recessed lanai was enclosed, a window bank was reduced in width, another was removed. This is all on the high facing facade. Metal sliding doors were added. A pair of front entry doors was replaced with a single door, and another side entry was removed entirely. That would be at rooms 200 and 203. And additional material changes were made to the interior. That included covering up all the tongue and roof, wall, and ceiling board with chipboard in various places in the house. So we didn't even know actually whether it was there or whether it was in. The 1960s lanai was removed and rebuilt on wood columns. Glazed wood entry doors were installed at the lanai front entry on 200. Three banks were restored. The wall between the kitchen 201 and dining 200 was removed. The changes to floor finishes, appliances, and layout were made to the kitchen and baths. 201, 202, 205 respectively. The original interior and exterior materials were restored throughout. Next slide, please. These are pre and post rehabilitation photos, top and bottom. This is the front facade. Of the front and side, all the wall side of the building. Next slide, please. On the side, as well as the rear elevation. And there's a 1960s lanai. There's a modernist style rail. The side of the facade, behind it. And this is the side looking back at the front in an oblique view. Then we go to the interior. The shot on the left is before rehabilitation, and we're looking at portions of the building that are covered with chipboard. I know it's difficult to see. If you look at the right hand side, you see the tongue and groove wallboard is again exposed. And then you can see the alterations that happened on the window. The window's facing the ocean, the high side, when they were altered. And in the before shot and in the after shot, they then returned to the original configurations. Same thing with the sliding doors, and replaced with right through the doors. This is looking from the interior towards the front entry, which is about the side of the building. And you can see on the left-hand side where a modern entry door has been added. And then the right-hand side where we go back to a pair of doors to the front entry in this case, replaced with wood. It has an extremely narrow transom, and that transom is original. A bedroom, in this case, it was not covered in the heated wallboard. wood floors. Next slide, please. This is a bathroom in the case where an added floor was removed, taken back to wood floors, and then countertops were redesigned and installed in the bathroom. So in a similar situation in this bedroom, glasses over the windows, always opening on the floor, returned back to the installation. Next slide. Taking on the left before the renovation or rehabilitation, and on the right. Rehabilitation of the Bianco Lica bookkeeper's house was performed during the pandemic. The house was in excess of $500,000. The personal dedication of the Millikens to the project exceeded the norm. Dora personally reglazed every pane of glass in the windows alone. Their completed rehabilitation has been met with accolades from passersby, who also thank them for saving this house. We ask that you recognize their hard work, substantial investment, and the property on the Millikens Bridge for placing. Do you have any questions?
Any questions for Sandy?
I had a question concerning the German ownership of Lahaina Ice Company and what happened during World War I.
What happened during World War I was actually preceded
them buying this property.
Yeah, it was like, I don't actually remember. I think it was 1970, it was either late 1917 or 1918 proper. Hackfeld, which owned Pioneer Mill and all the subsidiaries and all the land, ended up being essentially taken over by the U.S. government. And another company is formed specifically to acquire all of Pioneer Mill's assets, and that was American Factors. And a lot of Germans, like the manager of Pioneer Mill, who was Weinsheimer at the time, was a really good manager, and he was he had surprisingly a rapport with his workforce, and he was the one who actually went ahead and began making sure that all the employees had new housing instead of the dilapidated housing that they had. But he was run out of town, essentially. Ended up going to the Philippines to enter the plantation that he did in World War II. But other Germans like Freudenberg, you know, managed to convince those who were conscious of him that he was, you know, although he was a German immigrant, that he was a guy in the whole America, they did not assume that people like that, so it's really kind of dicey. But all of the assets went to America. So that includes Lahaina's company.
The other question I had was regarding the reference to Lunaville.
Lunaville, yeah, what about it?
I was wondering if this house was part of.
It remains conjectural because Book Camp, which predated Lunaville, I believe, Book Camp was closed down and all the buildings were moved to various points in Lahaina. And Lunaville seemed to be, since it was just before. The Front Street properties were actually either moved or built new. Because it wasn't a gridded camp, that suggested that houses had been located there but were moved, relocated elsewhere. Those were the only two sources that possibly used to take dwellings and move to Front Street.
Then I have a quick question. The lattice original feature as well?
The square lattice?
Over the entrance.
Oh, the trellis?
Yeah.
Yes. It's duplicated on the house next door.
Okay.
few questions, and I apologize. I'll defer to my architectural colleagues if I'm mistaken. But when it was withdrawn, it was a reason so they could move forward on the rehabilitation?
Yes.
Okay. So even though it wasn't subjected to it, did they have an architectural historian help with making sure they would meet standards of rehabilitation?
Yes.
Okay. And then the maps inside, so the floor plans, so did you say these were before or these were after rehabilitation?
The map?
The floor plans here.
The floor plans that are in that nomination room before, they're keyed to two shots, because I've included both before and after shots. The shots are taken from the same location, but in the case of the second floor plan in particular, actually the first floor plan as well, you've got a portion of the building.
Okay.
And the high side, there are three rooms that have been removed.
Okay. So I'll defer to my architectural colleagues. It seems like there was a lot of, you know, changes and alterations which maybe aren't otherwise reflected in the nomination currently, correct?
If I were to respond about the floor plan, yes. I prepared the floor plan specifically for this hearing.
Okay.
And the problem that we had was that I had no architects that were available to do any revisions on the drawings.
Would it be possible for you to just add those floor plans that you showed from after this?
That's the intent, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, these are manipulated, these were manipulated PDFs, so I couldn't get to the level of countertops and appliances and fixtures. So that's why they tend to be thematic, but they do show what has happened.
You had said that some of the houses in this area were constructed there and some were moved there?
Yes.
This house?
We don't know.
Don't know.
They spoke in terms of, all the emphasis in the annual reports are on the manager's house. So they say, okay, the manager's house is built in 24, but I can go through 25 all the way to 30. There's no mention of houses being built new or relocated to or down. But we know in fact that there were no houses here at this location prior to 24.
So you know the date that it appeared here, but it could actually be an older house that was from another location.
These aren't HSPA standard plans, which are smaller, 6/6 usually in the fenestration. I mean, these are pretty elegant little dwellings.
Is there an architect attached to the manager's house?
Yeah, William Desmond. And I think a decade ago I was asked to do an assessment of that building, and unfortunately so many alterations that have taken place. They preserved the Malka-facing entry, but the fenestration has been altered on all the other sides. That's really
important. Was he an architect for the company?
No, William Desmond was a private architect, and actually in Wailuku, and he starts out, I think, he's involved with the military and spent some time in the Philippines, and then comes to Maui and for 10 years produces an incredible amount of buildings. So he does a lot of the dwellings over on Sand Hills, which was one of the elite of the city, so attorneys and doctors and other elites moved there, and then he got contracted to do, you know, and like the manager's house.
Okay, but he's not explicitly linked with this house.
No.
Any other questions for Stanley? Okay. Anybody like to make a motion?
Go ahead, Graham. Give it
okay.
A practice run.
Is this also being considered for national register or no?
Just the way register
just
right away. Now.
Okay. So I'll make a motion to nominate the bookkeeper's house to the Hawaii Register of Historic Places under criteria A and C. Second.
I'll second it.
Second it. Any further discussion? All in favor of placing this on the state register?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, unanimous. Thank you, Stan.
Thank you.
Yeah, if
excellent
you could,
job, Stanley, as always.
Up the post renovation floor plans.
Yeah, I'll probably do that by this coming week.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Next item is the staff report.
There's not a huge amount to report on this time. I guess the good news is that of our 41 positions, we have 39 filled. Just received an applicant for one of the other positions. That's an architectural story position. With the last position, in order to advertise positions here, we have to get the governor's approval. That paperwork is stuck at the Department of Finance. It's been here for months, but until the governor signs off on it, we can't move. That's our ethnographer. We're well into the transition period. Suzanne Case, who is my boss and also the SHPO, she is term limited, so she will be leaving as chair of the department on the 30th of December. Should her position actually expires after the new governor is inaugurated. We're well into the transition. We've provided transition reports, and frankly, there's not much coming out of the governor-elect's staff at this point. There's sort of some rumors swirling around. We don't really have much yet. We have submitted the budget, but our orders were to submit a budget that duplicated last year. In terms of the 14 new positions, we're in the process of establishing them. My hope is we will have them established and authorized, advertised by January, which is, I will tell you, wildly optimistic. This is personnel matters move very slowly. But we are working on we've done what we can, I'm hoping we can get all of this through before the inauguration, because at that point, although Suzanne Case remains the chair of the SHPO, she's within a few weeks of leaving, and her real influence goes away. And all of the all the people of budget and finance who are political appointees, people who actually she can talk to, they'll be gone, because all of the Then Natural Resources, DHHL, and Ag, those chairs are chairs of boards which have meetings after the inauguration, so their positions all end at the end of December. All of the other directors, they leave on December 5th. They're done at noon on December 5th, which is when Governor-elect Green will be inaugurated. It's fun times, and unfortunately, not the most productive times for us to be working. But that's it's the nature of the work. I think that's pretty much it at this point. Anybody have any questions?
Yeah. Do you have the islands all have their own archaeologists now?
Well, all of the islands have archaeologists assigned to them. We have an archaeologist physically on Maui every 2 months. So the guy who was there, his wife she's in the Army, she's transferred to Tennessee. So he lives in Tennessee with his wife. He worked, works remotely for 2 months, and then he comes back here for 2 months. And that's been going on for some time. One of the things of the new positions we have in archaeologists, and one of them will be for Maui, and that person will have to live on that. That may be a problem, because there are a lot of archaeologists in the state of Hawaii. Frankly, I hear from the SHPRs in Western U.S. that all of them are facing the same problem, not just the state government, but the archaeological firms are having real trouble with it, because most of the people who came into the discipline, about my time, are almost all of them are retired, or on the verge of retirement, and the next cohort just seems to be smaller. We'll see what happens. We have been very successful in recruiting. We filled all those positions. I think some of you may remember, Nick remembers the good old days. when I arrived here, we had 31 positions and 17 vacancies. And we weren't even recruiting. And it's taken a while. And one of the things that the legislature did in the last session is that they approved significant wage increases for the technical staff, which I think will help. I'm hoping it will help with recruiting.
Okay. I want to congratulate you on all that you've gotten done. Curiosity about the CLGs. Does Big Island have a CLG now as well?
All of the counties except Honolulu have a CLG. They have commissions, and they've been approved by the Park Services as CLGs. As you may know,
that was going to be my next question.
County is in the process of attempting to actually stand up their commission, which has been on the books for decades, the mayor has not appointed members. Tommy Waters is chair of the county council, and Esther Kianaina, who is this vice chair, is her title, have been pushing hard to get that commission up and running. They did pass an ordinance just recently. They're sort of negotiating. I think they're negotiating with the mayor to try to get appointments made. Once that happens, we'll certainly encourage them to become, to get certified. That's another step. And frankly, when I talk to the staff over there, it's not clear that anybody has figured out how this is going to work and how it's going to relate to, for example, DPP. The ordinance has, I believe, three positions in it. So it's not just a matter of creating a commission, they actually created some staffing. So I'm cautiously optimistic that this is going to move forward in a very effective way.
Yeah, I talked to the mayor about it. He was quite enthused. Sam was enthused.
Well, I'm glad to hear. I've not talked to the mayor's staff or the mayor, but I have talked with the county council on a fairly intensive basis. And for those of you who are not aware of this, Esther was the person to hire. She was the first deputy to deal with Orange, and she wrote her on that process. So.
I told him I was already taken.
Standing up the commission is, we all know what it's like. Finding able commissioners is not an easy thing. I don't know that the county has quite as stringent disclosure requirements, which is, so many people feel very burdensome for the state. But I still think Esther and Tommy are really pushing this.
I was surprised by the advertisers, Star Advertisers editorial. It sounded like they thought it was an archaeological program.
For many people on the outside, archaeology and archaeological issues is what they interact with us on. we have a much lower, much higher threshold, I guess, for the historic structures for them to become problems. But I would say, at least two thirds of our work is archaeology. So people, that's the biggest part of what we do, the most visible part of what we do. And I'm hoping, you know, that the new positions include two architectural historians. So I'm hoping that, and I think you've all heard me, well, except for brand new members, you've all heard me say, listen, we don't do enough proactive historic preservation stuff. We just don't. And we do that, we don't because we don't have the resources to do it. And I'm hoping with the additional staff, in particular the architectural historians, and with one of the new positions as a historian as well, that we will be able to do more proactive stuff. And people will not just think we're all about burial sites. I mean, because when it comes down to it, archaeology in the public mind is mostly burial sites, because that's the stuff that people talk about. And, you know, I know from my experience dealing with the media, I mean, they are ill-informed. And, you know, they are, when I get interviewed, they're often shocked at when I tell them, no, that's not what we are. That's not what historic preservation is. And I do think, I mean, we all suffer from the fact that this is historic preservation. When, you know, preservation in the United States is a process rather than an outcome. Very few people recognize that, understand that as the reality. Okay.
Well, thanks.
So, I think the next item is what the preservation plan. Okay, so
was supposed to make this presentation. She's AWOL.
I don't know where she is. So I was going to start with a sort of a background thing on this, and then I'm
Scatman, always a pleasure. Good to see you again, sir. Good to see me. Hey, good job.
So I will make the presentation, and I'll start with sort of some background. You know, some of you may know this is our the most recent plan, which expired in 2017. We're a little behind the curve here, and that is in part because when we started this process, we were still a high-risk recipient. We were in the corrective action plan phase, and our original plan was to hire the firm that prepared this plan, and you know, we had gone through the whole contracting process. We had selected them. We had negotiated the contract, but because we were under the, in the high risk status, the contract had to be approved by the Parsons. They just wouldn't approve it. They kept going, well, why is it so expensive? It's Hawaii. We know why it's so expensive. It's just too expensive. And so we went back and forth for about 8 months over that. And ultimately they were never going to. Honestly, it was our money. We had the money. They just wouldn't approve it. It wasn't like we were asking them to send us a check. So then we went back to, okay, how can we do this in-house, which is what we have done now. And then we spent another year and a half, 2 years, trying to get agreement with the Parsons on what the plan would be. My original plan, my real original intent was that the plan would be principally a 5-year work plan for SHPD. And the Park Service would not approve that. So this is a direct quote, must be aspiration. It must be a document that anybody in the state can pick up and look and say, oh, here's something I could do. Well, if you look at this plan, which is meets their aspirational guidance, and you'll see that almost none of that stuff has been done unless SAPD did it. And we didn't do very much because we have the resources. People just don't pick up statewide plans and say, oh, yeah, I'll do that. It just doesn't happen. But that's nevertheless the Park Service's position. And that means, as I said, they were adamant. They would not approve a plan that was not this aspiration thing. So we move forward. trying to do our best to, are we still recording? I'm not sure I want this on the record. Actually, it has to be on the record.
I was going to say.
We can't do that.
Except for that last line can't be on the record.
So we went forward with it, understanding that at the end of the day, the Park Service cares what you say and not very much what you do. So if we say, if the plan says what they want to hear, they're fine. And they're totally fine with the fact that this plan is, you know, there's not, almost nothing in this plan that was going to get done was done. They just, I mean, it just drives me crazy. I'm sorry. It's driven me crazy since, you know, I worked at Navajo Land to do this. So for 30 plus years, I've been wrestling with this. And some of why we were so late in this process is that, honestly, part of this requires me to lie. I have to lie to the Park Service in order to get this thing, and that drives me nuts. Anyway, enough said on that. So,
I don't think aspirations can ever be a lie, really.
Except I feel like it's a lie when you know damn well you're never going to do it. You know, I aspire to run a marathon, and it's never going to happen. You know, it's just not. Moving on.
And who you deal with? Who is the Park Service now?
I don't remember.
Is it San Francisco Support Office or something like that?
No. This is all through headquarters. All the stuff that used to be done in the regional offices.
So it all goes through WASO. They still call themselves WASO?
Yep. So all of this is through headquarters in D.C.
I actually think that's better.
Well, in theory, it would provide more uniformity nationwide, but it does mean that they are, it's harder to contact them, especially if we're out here, because the
time difference,
time difference, it's 5 or 6 hours, depending on the time of year. They are all a lot like Hawaii, where you gotta work very early to avoid the traffic. If you've been in D.C. and driven in from the suburbs, you know what that's like. So, scheduling time to talk, and at the same time, honestly, look, the Trump administration did a wonderful job of hollowing out the Park Service. They were just, people left because they couldn't deal with it, and they were prohibited from filling vacancies. So dealing with the Park Service, it's not their fault. This is what I'm trying to say. But it's been difficult. But we started the process internally. Tamara Luthing, who was our ethnographer, is the original leader of this. And of course, in this process, COVID hit. So we did have a number of, we sent out surveys to all of the people who commented on the prior plan, and we also to other organizations and individuals who had an interest, to county governments and so on. We then hold virtual meetings, many virtual meetings. And to be honest, the virtual meetings, what we heard mostly was, what a lousy job we're doing protecting burial sites. Occasionally, the state government is illegal because the kingdom still exists and stuff. And of course, the burial site stuff is not something that the Park Service has anything to do with. That's state law. It's the one thing we do that we can't spend federal money on. So we didn't get a huge amount of input we got a huge amount of input. And there is a lot of stuff that has to do with more general historic preservation issues, but the overwhelming majority of comments had to do with those burial sites. So we then went through all of the guidance from the Park Service on it. We have to plan. We've got a draft done. I have to tell you that it's not ready for prime time, and that's entirely my fault. Tamara left. Kaihiki Solis, took over. She's got it to this point. It's been on my desk for a month, and I just, every time I sit down and say, oh, now I can sit down and edit and review, and, a brush fire starts up. So it just, I mean, it
sense.
Right. It's nobody's fault but mine, to be clear. But we are getting close. When we do get the draft to a point where I think it's ready for review, we'll send it to you. The board does have a statutory right to review the plan, and we will send it to you for review. Whether we will, and you know, we'll have to figure out perhaps in consult, well, maybe we can do it here. How you want to do it, whether you want to give just as individual board members, give comments back to us, or if you want to do it in a meeting, we can certainly schedule time for the next meeting for that purpose. And I have no preference, it's up to you.
Depending on the agenda, I think that would be probably the best, yeah.
Okay.
Whether we got time for it.
We'll plan on that.
What are some of the aspirational stuff for pertains to architecture?
As I said,
it pertains to architecture?
Or to what we tend to do.
I think in there, the section on architecture is organized by the different program areas. I think one program area that we were talking about building out more is work with the Certified Local Government Program and, getting more grant money out there that can be proactive for those communities to help identify resources. There's a fine line in terms of bricks and mortar projects that CLG program funds can be used for, so making sure that those funds get consistently awarded to projects that, produce for the community and that sort of thing. Expanding the federal tax credit program and the state tax credit program mm-hmm. are two big, aspirational goals, I think. We're getting projects in a slow trickle. I think that when Alan first started, I don't think we had many, if any at all. And now we're getting a few a year, more than two, but less than 10 a year.
Is the state program set to expire for
in two years? We have found a sponsor for the bill that will extend it for an additional 5 years. So, and also to over that period, that 5 year period, increase the amount of the cap on the tax credit. So it's not going to be huge, but it's hard to sell the idea. I mean, tax credits are a hard sell anyway. Although, Sylvia Loop is now Lieutenant Governor, and she really was hard to convince when she was Chair of Finance. It's a marvel to me that she agreed to it in the first place. But it's hard to sell. We need to expand the program, and we're getting like one a year.
And we need data to prove its economic viability. There's the federal tax credits are monitored by Record, and they produce a report annually on how many tax credits were awarded nationwide and what was the economic return. And so they make a really solid case, and some states across the nation still have that ability, whether either the statewide nonprofit or other groups that do similar studies on their state level programs if they have them. And this program is so new that we don't have enough data yet to advocate a good case for, how much was invested versus how much did it return. So I think we are hoping to expand the program for more time just to collect the data to prove that this is something that is worth investing in.
It was very effective in the old days when they still had the passive loss stuff and all that
mm-hmm.
back in the 70s. But
yeah.
It hasn't been as, it's not as attractive a program now as it was.
We were just notified by Park Service that they're starting to allow their personnel to travel again. So I'm trying to get John Sandor, our tax credit reviewer, out here to do some community outreach and meet with local, people, our office, developers, that sort of thing. So if that comes to fruition and there's a solid date, we'll definitely let you guys know in case you want to participate. If he does a listening in session or something.
I always thought there was more potential for the small-scale projects rental properties and even apartments within units, larger buildings and things like that.
Exactly. So for those of you who aren't familiar, it's all the federal program is income-producing. There's a requirement for income-producing investment. So the state tax credit you don't, there isn't an income producing component, so single family residential projects can apply for it, but there has been rumor that the federal government is looking into doing something for non-income producing properties, whether it's residential or more clear guidelines for nonprofits who are located in historic buildings to be able to transfer or sell the tax credit so they can still do rehabilitation projects, but sell their credit to someone else to help finance it. So that's a whole other conversation for later on, but that kind of stuff for the state level program is, I think, some of the language that we've tried to include within the architecture component. I think there's also some language in there about developing the survey program that would help to identify historic properties, both for the National Register and then also for potential tax credit investment programs like tourism, that sort of mm-hmm. thing.
So what's the prognosis for the tax sort of relief, real estate tax relief program? What's
hard to say.
I've always thought it was too generous myself, especially when you start getting $12 million properties and stuff.
I think certainly the county government would like to change it. But their approach to changing it has been in the past is we're just going to do it. And, you know, nobody wants, well, outside of the government, nobody wants that. Nobody's, you know, so because that's their approach, right? It's like, well, you know, we want to adjust it. I mean,
my personal feeling has always been half would be enough.
Or maybe there should be an upper limit. You could have the tax credit up to a certain
amount half per year. Or half of what you normally would pay. That would seem to be more equitable.
They don't consult us on those questions. They simply just, somebody introduces an ordinance, and that's quite often the first time you hear about it.
I mean, I think half off would still keep the program moving. People would still do it. And, I remember doing one property that was like $45,000 a year, and they went down to $500.
Well, I can't afford real estate anyway, so don't But Nick, skin off my back.
So what's going to happen with condos as they come online? Is that ever going to, are we beginning to adjust to that idea?
What do you mean by that?
Well, at some point, Marco Polo will be a listed property.
Eligible is now, isn't it?
What's that?
It's eligible now.
It's eligible.
I mean, what's the real question, though? I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm just wondering if eventually that'll be extended to owners of condominium.
The property tax incentive. I feel like there's language currently, I can't remember. I feel like it's limited though, right? The current residential abatement, I don't remember, it's not an abatement, is it called? I feel like it's limited to a number of units per building.
Yeah, that's kind of where my question's going.
Don't quote me on it as being accurate, but I feel like there's like a limitation like that in the current like policy. But in terms of the federal tax credit, they're still eligible for that. Like the HOA can apply for that. Do rehabilitation of like common areas.
If they're rental.
Yeah.
If they're owned, would not be eligible for the federal credit. And you know, the Park Service may be talking about adjusting that, but that would require a statutory change.
Yeah.
The statute itself says, and there have been a couple attempts to expand it, and those have, there's a meaning of trade credits to the, for owner, non-income producing properties.
Yeah.
At the federal level.
I guess my last question is the prognosis on, when I first came here, I had this vision of historic districts, and it seems like maybe that train left the station, we'll never get them. What do you think?
To get more historic districts statewide?
Yeah.
I think that we need to, and this is something that, we can finesse the language in the plan, but I think that there's a real possibility for that. I think it's it's a balance of property owners agreeing to it and recognizing that if the listing, say, for residential historic district comes with some review and compliance component to it, that the carrots and sticks make sense for the property owners, where
yeah.
it's something that is a viable, I mean, it's the same here as it is in any other state, and I think a lot of it is, you know, balancing that out with the local communities to find out what's best for them and to make a good case for why investment in preservation is, you know, worth it. So that would be like a continued goal, I think, that we should look at our language in the plan to make sure that we're addressing that. In some way, because it is complicated. We understand
that. Yeah, I think, and I think there's been a political shift to the right since the time those were personal property rights and things like that.
I think that's a sort of a district by district question. I mean, one of the reasons Hanukkah, you see those individual nominations, is that, you know, that Ross and Laura have to go convince the property owner that getting this listed isn't going to be a burden on them.
Same with Manoa. Manoa was an ideal historic district.
Yeah,
parts
yeah,
of it.
You know, and they did that because they got pushback when they said, let's do district. Their hope is that once they have sort of a, there's some threshold where we'll have enough properties listed, that people say, well, you know, this isn't so bad, let's do the whole thing. I mean, you've been there. I mean, it couldn't be more ideal case, as you say, with Manoa. But you know, I think that, I mean, we have very strong feelings about property rights in this country.
And Hawaii even included, yeah.
You know, and it's been fueled by the right wing and the radical right, but it's always been there.
Yeah.
This isn't new stuff.
Well, Los Angeles, after the Getty did that big survey. My daughter's working for the city of Los Angeles doing historic districts, and they embraced it.
Well, I think too, to a certain, I mean, I can't say that this is true across the board, but I think that one hesitancy that I've been hearing from certain, like from members of the public who have to come in for various state level HRS reviews under Chapter 60, is like there's, I think, a misconception that if your property is listed in a district or individually, that the state, like our office, is going to tell them that they can't do some stuff to their property. And that's, I think, a misconception that we could do a better job as an office to try to, you know, combat that assumption. Because oftentimes, like most cases, everything that property owners want to do is completely appropriate and okay to do, but there might be a couple concerns here or there, things to avoid or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that because there is a statewide regulation that does trigger a review by our office, there is this misconception. But in a lot of communities that have local historic districts, there may be a CLG or a historic district commission or some office within local government that has the same role to play that our office at the
mm-hmm.
state level has. So it's not a unique situation, but it is something that we have to openly, you know, provide information to the community about, that this isn't a scary thing. We're not going to take your property rights away, but it does provide, you know, these other programs that would be open to you if you, you know, did agree to list your property in a district or individually. And by the way, you'll be helping to preserve Hawaiian history. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think those are all good thoughts. I agree with you. I think one of the things always is to try to convince people that it's not really their house so much, but it's a lot next to them that doesn't have a house on it. Yeah. To be protected from new development in some way.
Yeah, and I think that there is some local support for that. There are definitely community groups that I think in some instances might see it from that perspective as something to support rather than the actual preservation of some of these districts, but just like to maybe introduce form-based codes or something like that that would prevent height or massing requirements.
Design review too, to make
all
sure.
All of those things.
And you know, while for certain types of permits, they have to come to us, in theory. But we, you know, for a privately funded project, we can't say no. We can't tell a homeowner that, no, you can't do this. All we can say is, well, here's what we think you should do, or here, if you're going to do what you're proposing, here's what we think you should do as mitigation. Bearing in mind that unless it's a listed property or a contributing property in the historic district, those are exempt. We don't get, you know, those don't come to us at all unless they're listed. People don't understand that, but I mean, we get a in terms of the sort of the neighborhood stuff, we regularly get people contacting us saying, well, why are you allowing this, you know, these people who did this, they're building a, you know, they're building a mega home right next to me. Well, first of all, we didn't see it, unless, the, you know, unless it was sent to us to determine whether there was an archaeological concern from excavation, but the construction of a new house anywhere is not subject to review. And the fact that it has, you know, it may have an obvious effect on the neighborhood, that's, we're not getting those either. And even if we did, all we could say, geez, we think you ought to redesign this. And if they don't, and looks, I mean, you know, building permits are controlled by the counties, period.
Right.
You know, they have to get, you know, where they think that permit may affect historic, has a potential to affect historic properties, they have to send it to us. And not always. But they're, you know, that's what the law says. But nothing in there says you gotta, you know, you gotta do what SAP says.
I always thought it was awkward to have the state regulating districts here in Oahu.
And
I think it's really important that we get the Oahu CLG.
I agree with you. I mean, we're the only state in the country that reserves to the state authority to review historic properties. Entirely, bearing in mind that in some states this means, you know, where there isn't a state law saying the counties have to do it, there are plenty of cities and counties that don't regulate historic preservation law. Hmm. But where they do, where those states do have that kind of law, it's entirely at the municipal or county level that those decisions are made. It doesn't come.
So I think there's a lot of opportunity for special districting at a state, at a county level in Oahu, Kapuhulu, Wailea Avenue, Queen Street. There's a lot of potential.
And you know, in Lahaina, on Maui, for example, I mean, this is, it's not confusing enough. There's the National Landmark. There's a National Register District, which has a different boundary. And there is a county overlay, Preservation District overlay. And in Lahaina, you know, the county ordinance does say that, you know, if it's in Lahaina, we see it. But that's an exception. You know, the other historic districts, we don't see it necessarily. That's a county decision whether or not to send it to Shifty.
So, I think good news, I hope, with the, as long as the mayor understands, he seemed to.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he's got a county council that wants this. And you know, we've been pushing, you know, when I got here, we pushed Calvo to appoint it, and, you know, I sent him a letter, didn't hear back. I did hear from a friend of mine who worked for him saying, yeah, he, you know, in Caldwell's mind, historic preservation is the swimming pool. You know, that Shifty's stopping him demolishing the swimming pool, and he's not going to, you know, be on historic preservation grounds. And so that in his mind is that, no, you know what, we're not going to have this. It was a strange conversation, to say the least. Because, and I will say this, Caldwell was very supportive of the work that they were doing to rehab the Honolulu Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a first-rate job with the, you know, the stuff they did. If you get outside of the public areas, there's a lot of stuff to be done. But the stuff they did, he was a champion.
Well, his house was listed, and then he was part of the tax relief, real estate relief program for a while. He pulled out of it, but he kept his house listed and still listed out.
Could you introduce your staff?
Jess?
I'm Jess, Jessica Puff. I just started a month ago. I'm the new architecture branch chief.
Jessica was here as on staff before she went back to graduate school to work on her PhD.
Welcome back.
Mary?
Mary Kadama. I've been here a little bit over a year.
Julie Bluffs, architectural historian. Tomorrow marks my 4-year anniversary.
Oh, congratulations. Seems like that yesterday, huh?
This is a, I'm sure everybody here will tell you, you know, it's a, sometimes it seems like you just got here, and sometimes it feels like it's been a lifetime. You know, and it's when you get to the point where more days feel like it's a lifetime, it's time to be looking for something else.
Well, Mary's a graduate of our program, so proud graduate of the DARC program, like Graham. So.
I had a question about the Irwin Memorial Park and Chinatown Historic District updates for the next meeting. Who's responsible for those?
Well, I mean, that is, correct me if I'm wrong, that's HART.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. HART is doing both of those.
Yeah.
And they have a new consulting firm, which, forgetting their name, but I think I have it in my notes somewhere from the meeting yesterday. But they have a new consulting firm that they've brought on to fill some of their vacancies, because I don't know if we need to get to the weeds about this. The programmatic agreement for that project requires that they have different SOI qualified Secretary of Interiors professionals who fill like archaeology and architectural historian positions. And they currently don't have staff that meet any of those requirements because they've all left or been let go. So they've had to hire a consulting firm to essentially manage the historic preservation mitigation requirements under that programmatic agreement. And the Irwin Park nomination, and the, what was the other one? I'm sorry?
Chinatown.
And the China, yeah, that update, they're supposed to be working on the updates to both of those. And they've been telling us when they want them put on the agenda for you all. So hopefully we do get a good draft that they actually present. But yeah, let me see if I can't find
it. They were supposed to be on this meeting, and they withdrew the nomination.
Yeah.
I think Mason did the architectural study for the park, Ralph.
Okay.
And
yeah,
I think
not for Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody else from Chinatown.
Yeah.
But just
you know, somebody, the prime is an A&E firm, and I don't know who doing the actual work.
Yeah, I think that the consultants right now doing the architectural assessments is a firm called Kim Lee and Horn, and I feel like they are based out of California, but I could be wrong about that. I feel like they're based out of California, though, but they I think they have an office here or personnel here.
Where's the third name? Kim Lee and
Horn, H-O-R-N, I believe. Or at least that's how I have it written down.
There is a little controversy on Irwin, Ralph, because of the sort of descendants of the original donor feel that it's not
the Irwin parking lot.
That there's something sinister going on.
An added complication is that the donation appears to, at least they believe, that they have some residual property rights. And that sort of, I think they actually presented her in Park once, and that was where they just sort of stalled when the descendants raised those issues. And, you know, I talked to the AG staff about those property rights, and they kind of went, You know, and I mean, sort of their attitude was, you have to assume the worst when it comes to property rights.
Not the return of the right property to the descendants.
Well, I think that at least they believe that if it doesn't remain a part, that it does revert to them. They don't want it back. They want it to remain a park, and they seem to feel somehow or other the nomination is going to lead to, if not, you know, ending it as a park, but it will lead to changing the dimensions, you know, and that sort of stuff. I think
and the recognition that parking is part of its history.
Yeah.
I think that's seriously, that's part of it. It was made into parking quite early in its history, so.
Yeah. Well, they don't want the parking expanded, and that's not, you know, anyway. So this is classic historic preservation stuff. Nobody understands what the heck we do. We might as well be physicists. I have to remind people all the time, listen, this is not rocket science. No, don't make it into something that isn't.
Don't give that away, because I try to tell everybody it's rocket science, right?
And that's why there's a graduate certificate.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you know, when I first got here, I've been here about a year. I went on vacation, and I appointed Hernando Rodriguez, who is the burial site program director. I put him in charge, and afterwards, we were talking, and he said, I just was really uncomfortable with signing the review letter, so he didn't. And I said, look, if it doesn't make sense to you, it doesn't make sense. It isn't so hard that that anybody will well educated even guys would. If it doesn't make sense to you, then yeah, it shouldn't be signed. But if it makes sense to you, get it out the door. But it is a I think we all face this on some level or other, that people think this is way more complicated than it, or they make it more complicated than it needs to be.
Well, it comes back to the lawyers again. They managed to make early on, when you look at the preservation in the 70s, it was so naive, and you just kind of pushed ahead and saved old-timey buildings.
Yeah.
So this nomination is likely to be contested.
Well, it's not clear. It depends on whether or not somebody sits down with a descendant and say, when the objections first came to me, I couldn't even make sense of it, because it was so so completely inconsistent with the intent. And I couldn't understand how they had reached this conclusion. I have had a phone call, one phone call, and basically they were, by the time the basic conversation was they were unloading it. Never got to the point where I could talk to them about it. They were so invested in their fears. So whether or not it'll be contested, I don't know. In terms of, I guess I would certainly, if they do contest it, we'll take it to the Attorney General and say, do they have a right to contest it? If they have a property right, they absolutely do have a right. If they don't have a property right, then it's a matter of, that's kind of a political judgment.
So you and I had sort of talked about when this property came before us before, and we thought it would potentially be contested, and so we had talked a little bit about what happens, but maybe you could do a quick brief for them.
Yeah. The standard the Attorney General has set is when somebody comes to you and says, we're going to contest this decision, the guidance that we're given is that at that point the board should stop and not take action until, I don't know what would happen in this context. I do know what happens in the context of the Board of Land and Natural Resources. But, what the contested the reason that contested cases exist is that these kinds of boards operate informally. Witnesses are not sworn in. The only evidence that's presented is typically the nomination. And so your action, there's a due process question, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And so the contested case is the opportunity for formal legal proceeding is due process, and the outcome of that then is presented to the board, in this case the review board, where the hearing officer will say, here's all of the evidence that was collected and presented, and here's my analysis of it, and here's my recommendation. And believe me, I don't want a contested case. They are expensive. We had a contested case on Maui on an archaeological permit that cost us, the hearing officer alone cost us $50,000. And I also had to pay the court report. And it took more than a year. It's just a nightmare process. Nobody wants to get into contested cases if they can help it. But that's the process. So really the first step, if at the time, if the board has acted, so a person doesn't have to tell you up front. They would have to, before they walk out of the room at the end of the meeting, they have to tell you they intend to contest it. And once they walk out the door under the rules, they no longer have that right. But if they do make a verbal, notification that they're going to contest it, then that sort of stops the action. But they also have to follow it up with a written notification that they're contesting it. They have 10 days after the close of the meeting to do that. And if we get that letter at that point, we would go to the AG and say, tell us, advise us on this.
So we have to take action on the Irwin Park nomination in order for there to be something for them to contest?
Well, it would have to be presented. So, sort of the more, all boards and commissions in Hawaii are fairly informal. And we're more informal than, say, the Board of Natural Resources, because they deal with much more consequential stuff. But somebody would make a presentation. So in our case, it would be, the nomination would be presented. And then the chair would ask if anybody else wants to give testimony. And at that point, the person, the people, if they come and they object, at that point they say, I'm going to contest this. And at that point, the advice to the board from the AG is to just defer action on it until something gets worked out. And, it's one of these things. Every time I have to walk my way through it. If the board doesn't take action, what are they contesting? There's no, there's no decision to contest.
Well, it's also already listed, correct?
It is, yes. Yeah. So this is just an update of the existing nomination.
That is a mitigation requirement that they complete it and they present it.
Right. So it's like a revision of the original.
Yeah.
But I thought it was, I remember Maggie, Angie giving the, I thought it was perfectly open and honest.
But it is different than the original nomination.
Right, because it does talk about parking as part of its history. Yeah. But Michelle seemed to think that there was really an intent of TARC to somehow develop the property as a result of this revised nomination. That seems to be the issue. But we have seen people, and we did see the railway project where they admitted a building, which was a little sinister. So they don't always face straight with us.
I mean, I don't think it's in this case, but I think Michelle is, I think she misunderstands. She's perfectly legitimate. I mean, there are times when historic preservation is weaponized to stop or oppose a project that people oppose on other reasons. All environmental processes can be weaponized. That's not the case here. I do think Michelle is completely genuine, and I just think she's confused. And so it will depend on what happens when Park finally says, "Yeah, we're ready to go public with this." We're sort of operating on the assumption that it will be on the next board,
March
agenda.
The March meeting, I think. That's a Chandra thing.
We won't. We aren't going to know until we're getting ready to prep the agenda, the draft agenda.
They said something about having an offer into someone to fill the architectural historian position there. So if anything changes, like if that person reviews the nomination and decides they need to make changes to it or something like that, see that possibly being an outcome that may delay that nomination from going before the next board, but we'll have to wait and see with them. I don't know of anything else that would delay that nomination from going before you guys at the next meeting, other than maybe something like that, or additional information that they need to make a revision to it for. So.
It's not a nomination, though, it's just an update.
Yeah.
Just an update.
That's, I'm sorry, I should have been clear, but yeah, exactly.
Property is listed as right now.
Yeah.
And this is a, to be clear, this is a requirement of the park manager being covering the real budget.
Yeah.
They have no choice but to present it. I have, you know, we've had numerous conversations about this particular mitigation requirement in the park manager agreement. And I have told them, I mean, it's not just, there are a number of properties they either had to nominate or revise nominations for. And I, you know, my position has always been, you must present it to the board. You know, and if the board acts, you're done. Because once the board acts, it's no longer under Hart's control. You know, it goes to the Park Service, and the Park Service may or may not listen. You know, that's a decision, you know, but Hart can't be held accountable for that. But they do have to present it. You know, what I told them after, when they withdrew it, my view was in terms of, as a mitigation requirement, that because the potential for this contested case sort of is always out there, that I don't think, you know, unlike some other nominations where you say, well, we did the nomination, we're done, right? Well, no, this is one where there is an external factor that's making it possible to get action on this by the board. You know, and the board, in my view, has to take action one way or the other. They don't have to recommend a property just because Hart is required to present it. You know, if you guys say no, then they're still done as far as I'm concerned.
And the property is still listed.
Exactly.
Well, in this case, yeah. I mean, it's still listed. It's listed as is. But they, frankly, are a little gun-shy for you know, that involves decisions and attitudes that I don't pretend to understand.
Yeah.
This was a 1970s nomination, Ralph, so it's very, very thin.
Do you, I mean, have you all had access to that original nomination? Is that, that's probably something we should get all out to you if we haven't already.
I've seen it before, but that's...
If you want to look at the two in comparison to one another, that would probably be really helpful.
You know, Bill is right. I mean, the most early nominations are really thin documents. I mean, you know, not a National Register nomination that was more than 3 pages long.
Stanley wasn't available back then.
Well, there's some history here. That, you know, in the very early days, every year we get a grant from the National Park Service, and you know, they have a formula of allocating the money that's appropriated by Congress. And right now, the formula is size of the state, population of the state, the number of buildings that were built before 1950. And there's every state gets sort of a base funding level, and then, you know, once they've allocated that to all of the states, then the rest of the money is allocated according to this formula. Well, back in the early days, the formula also was, how many National Register nominations had you submitted to Park Service? You get more money, more nominations you do. And, you know, there were a bunch of other factors. Well, what happened was the SHPOs were going, well, you know, we can get more money. If we send in more nominations, and the Park Service, you know, at some point, I started work in Illinois in 78. So by 79 or 80, the Park Service said, you know, we're getting a lot of crappy nominations. So then they adjusted the formula, so you would get points that, you know, would get demerits for bad, your nominations that get rejected would reduce the size of your board. And at that point, the SHPO and the review board started to sort of, you know, insist on more rigorous nominations. And you know, I don't think it's quite as bad as it was, but I mean, when I worked in Illinois, basically a National Register nomination would, to document it properly, to get the SHPO to sign off it, get the review board to sign off it, basically you had to do the amount of work that somebody who was doing a master's thesis would have to do. And you know, the standards got really excessive. But that's sort of why, you know, that's why in But the very first time I dealt with a national landmark, National Historic Landmark in Illinois, it's the very first Fish and Wildlife, you know, National Wildlife Refuge. It's an NHL. And Fish and Wildlife Service called up, we're going to do some maintenance work on this building. What do we do? So I get the NHL out, say, well, you know, first question, is this building inside the NHL? It didn't have a boundary. It's like, well, what do you do with that? I mean, the older documentation is really, really neat.
I did a revisit of the Molokai Light many years ago, and the original nomination, I think, was, the description was something like a 109-foot tower, period. So it didn't even mention the keeper's residence or anything like that, so it's very thin. But Murtaugh, you probably met Bill Murtaugh. He was the founder of our program, but he always said, the average person, intelligent person, should be able to fill it out. You don't need to have specialists, but there's some flaws in that. Well, but I do think they've gotten excessive too, because they've gotten more intellectualized in a way that makes it harder.
A person who, you know, who can write clearly and has a little bit of research skills can do a national register nomination. But it's a real burden.
Yeah, it's a learning curve
really,
now.
It has really become specialist work. That's why you very rarely see property owners here. They're almost, you know, it's almost always done by professionals.
Now, if you take the 100 hours that the Paperwork Reduction Act says it takes to fill out the form, and then
they do give you the number of hours, and it's really short.
And if you were to multiply that by minimum wage, I think there already is a price tag.
They underestimate the number of hours.
I have no idea. You know, I see Don every meeting, usually with multiple properties. I've got no idea what he charges, but I bet it isn't. I bet it's not what you would be surprised, I think, how little he charges people. I mean, when I worked in Illinois, the House nomination, I left Illinois in 1983. Somebody getting a professional doing National Register nomination for them for a single building in, you know, just in 1983, it's between $5,000 and $20,000. So 40 years later, in Hawaii, what would it be? And I don't think anybody charges full rate on these things, unless they're doing it for a commercial.
I think Don is still around $1,500 to $2,000.
I think he's up to $2,000 now.
I remember we used to get people asking if students could do them, and they would balk at $250, and I was thinking, do you realize, you know, 100 hours is, you know.
$2 an hour.
There's only so far we can, you know, we and you can push back, because the Park Service, the keeper is the ultimate decision maker. I do think if the board were to sort of relax standards for a little while, that we would be okay, because the Park Service, I can't tell you how thrilled they are that we're actually sending nominations to them, because for years, SHPD did not.
I think that, that was a brilliant move to start having them all go ahead for the National Register.
Yeah. But I mean, the Park Service is just absolutely thrilled that we're sending them in, and there have been a couple that that the review board recommended, and I looked at them, because I had to sign the nomination form before goes in, and I'm looking at, I don't know. And ultimately I said, oh, what the heck, I can't be bothered to write a letter explaining why I'm sending this on without my signature. So, and they didn't blink. It's like, it's on.
I think the whole issue of the period of significance is something that we've been, I mean, I made that mistake in much of my career, because I find that each layer is significant and interesting, but the Park Service really goes back to roots on that. Like, what is the period that you want to, if you were to interpret this property, what is the period you want to return to?
So, I agree with you, Bill. I think that's enormously problematic. I mean, we're dealing with this almost daily. You know, the Naval Shipyard National Landmark, the period of significance is December 7th, 1941. The Kaneohe Airfield, same thing. So these national landmarks are significant for one day, in point of fact, you know, for about 4 hours. Mm. And the fact that, oh yeah, these were, they had something to do with the entire war. Well, yeah, but that's not what the nomination form says.
It's from the bullet hole date.
Well, in a way, it's easy, once you accept it, that they're still guided by that kind of notion of interpretation and restoration, that actually makes it easier. I had to do some nominations of plantations and Burton Islands, and without that guidance, it's really hard to, as each layer seems to have equal significance, and then you start losing why they're significant.
And I mean, the interesting thing is that's, you know, in practical terms, and, you know, this may be a response to political pressure, you know, sort of the boundary of the nomination is supposed to be the smallest boundary you can write that will protect the property. So they scrutinize boundaries. They scrutinize period of significance for the same reason that the, you know, this is, you know, it's in part it's a reflection of sort of the far right's property right in the movement. But it's also a reflection of this misunderstanding of preservation, what does preservation mean? It means you go through a process. I'm not going to stop. I'll start calling it something else.
I don't know if all the board knows this, but one of the big things that blew up in the National Register's face was back in, I think it was in the 80s, that big nomination of a landfill. And that was basically a wonderfully written nomination explaining the history of landfills and where this landfill fit, and I think that cost Carol Schull her job when they listed that. So.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of things going on there. I mean, look, they you know, some of this stuff, I don't disagree with it as a preservationist, but when I worked in Navajo, the state of Arizona, I think it got listed, but they certainly passed on a nomination for like an 11-mile segment of gas pipeline. It's the first gas pipeline in the state, completely underground. You can't see it. You can barely, you know, you get the right of way is marked so that people don't go into the backhoes. But this is, you know, it's on the, I will say it's on the national, certainly the state nominated. And, you know, that's a hard sell to, you know, Jane Q. Public. You know, what the hell are you guys doing?
I don't know. We have a beloved wastewater plant.
Well, yeah, I mean, so if there's a building, it's an easier sell. People can look at it and, you know, honestly, most of the time you look at a building and say, the mill manager house. And you look at this and say, that's a cool building. You don't need to know anything about architectural history. That's kind of a nice building. And, you know, so that's easier to explain to people. I mean, the Mosale Iron Pit, which is the largest open pit iron mine in the world on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, is a National Historic Landmark. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. I bet it doesn't make any sense to the mine manager.
It doesn't.
And moreover, when I worked in Illinois, there was the National Landmark Program spent a year trying to decide whether the continued mining was a threat to the landmark or just making it more of why it was a landmark. Hmm. I kind of felt like, yeah, you guys need to find other stuff to do with your time. Don't worry about this. But I mean, you know, those kinds of things which make perfect sense and are, you know, make perfect sense within the context both of what we do and what we think about historic preservation and are consistent with the rules are sometimes really tough for, you know, people, just man and woman on the street. They just don't get it. And, you know, it's hard.
That's
to.
Problem of professionalization, academic involvement, so I guess, and all that when you're so far ahead of the public on these things.
Well, it gets complicated too, and they're about to update National Register Bulletin 38, which is for traditional cultural properties, which if you guys haven't seen that, we can send that around to you too, because I think the public comment period may have just opened, or it's about to open and it goes through next spring, but because so much can be interpreted like in more of an ephemeral way with traditional cultural properties, like we have a very similar experience trying to convey to the public or different people, like in different levels of government or developers, like why a property is significant and that there is a property there that belongs to various groups for various reasons. So even if there's nothing built, no built environment, but it's still associated with cultural practice or experience or whatever,
it is counterintuitive to people who come from our end of things. Because I remember when they first put this into place, when Don King and Pat, what was her name?
Pat Parker.
Pat Parker were putting it together.
Yeah.
And, you know, parking for the rest of the board probably knows, may know this, a parking lot that was an annual site of some sort of Native American gathering.
It wasn't Native American, it was the descendants of Spanish colonial. I mean, it was a Latino.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it didn't have to have anything that seemed, I mean, it was filled with like McDonald's and stuff like that. There was nothing that would suggest that
annually they did a traditional dance there.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened every year since like 1690.
Wow.
And that was the very first property in New Mexico that was recommended for the National Register. You know, before it was recommended for the National Register, there was a consensus determination of eligibility by the SHPO and the federal agency that they were building a power line or something like that, and they intended to put a pole right in the plaza. So there is a misconception that traditional cultural properties are only Native American or
But many of them are, of course.
Well, the update is addressing the fact that they're not just associated, though.
Bulletin 38 said that. But I mean, to be fair, Tom and Pat and I were passing this thing back and forth, because ultimately that was I had done my dissertation on trying to find ways to protect the places which were most concerned to Native, particularly Navajo. That just didn't fit with the structure that existed before 1990.
But I always thought it was interesting. Most countries developed the kind of intangible cultural property protocols and stuff, and we never have. It's always been tied to the register and place, right? Which is, we don't nominate the dance.
Right. we don't nominate the dance ground.
Yeah.
And, in many countries, they would say this is, the dance is the cultural heritage.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's like, this, you're not familiar with this, but there's, now I'm forgetting it's the Sanilac petroglyphs in Michigan. I used to work at the Michigan Chippo there, so we're talking about their properties, but there is a petroglyph on a stone and I can't remember which tribe it is, but every year they go up there and they scrub this moss off the stone, and there were preservation groups trying to prevent them from doing that. And they were like, no, this is part of the reason why the stone is here and why it's significant, and we're going to continue to do this. And they still do, but it's going back to this larger conversation about, like, even the iron mine. When is the act seen as an adverse effect to the property, the very act that makes it historic to begin with?
By the way, since we're winding down, everybody has to watch that TV show, The Watcher, because there's the preservation component.
Yeah.
And at the end, one of them says something like, no, interior changes are not subject to the review by the commission.
Oh my gosh.
It's like horror suspense.
Mia Farrow wants to save the dumb waiter all along.
Oh, dumb waiter.
Thank you for the preservation plan summary.
Yeah.
And everything afterwards.
It's, I'm going to try to remember to send you the Irwin Park original and that link to the Bulletin 38 update comments. If, I think there's some other things from the Park Service that we have opportunity to comment on, and I can send you the link to those things as well. It's mostly consultation with NHOs, Native Hawaiian organizations, and tribes. They may be of interest with you just to have on your radar, or if you do want to provide a public comment, we can send you that too. But if there's anything else that you need, don't hesitate to ask.
Well, thank you, Jessica. I think it's nice that we get involved with a little more than just nominating nice houses in Lanikai. So.
We're diamond in.
We kind of got those all listed already. Manoa's probably drying up too.
Before they wash away.
Yeah.
Okay, next agenda is the 2023 meeting dates, March 24th, May 19th, August 11th, and November 17th. So if any of you know right now that you have an issue with any of those dates.
Right, I teach on Fridays. So
all of these are interfere
with. It's all right, I'll make plans.
Okay, and this is probably a good time for somebody to make a motion for a...
What's the date again? Okay.
Oh, it's March 24th, May 19th, August 11th, and November 17th. They're in item B.
I gotta double check. I have got some travel scheduled for March.
Okay.
Before you talk about the limited meeting,
yeah.
I think you're aware of this, Katie, but just so the board is whole, you know, the Office of Information Practices has advised us that the nominee that they're so limited meeting is subject to their approval, and they will not approve it unless the motion is specific. You know, these specific properties for these specific reasons. We can't do what we have been doing, which is saying we want to have a limited meeting for whatever comes across the agenda, and that's obviously there are. We hope there are going to be nominations coming in that we have not yet seen. So
that we would have in March?
For the March meeting. And as a consequence, it will not be possible to visit.
We can just visit the ones that are already
in. Just the ones that are specifically mentioned in the resolution, or the motion, excuse me. And you know, that's, OIP basically told us the last time, this is the last time we're going to approve something like this. It has to be specific.
Just for the sake of argument, can we do a virtual meeting where we do the motion for a limited meeting once we have a list of properties?
I'll have to check whether we can do an entirely virtual meeting now. We used to have authority for that during the pandemic, and those things have changed now that the governor's emergency order has ended, and I don't know how. We can do mixed meetings, but there has to be at least one person sitting in a room where the public can come see the board in action. We were going to meet in the boardroom downtown at the Lonnie Moco building, but they are revamping, ripping out all of the audio system and replacing it. So once that's done, then we would have, if it's the right day, we would have the capacity to have, say, Katie sit in the room and share the meeting, which would be just that short meeting. I think that's legitimate, but we will have to talk with the OIP about that.
Yeah, I'm just bringing it up, because honestly, I've been on the board when we could do limited meetings and when we couldn't, and doing the site visits made a huge difference in how we looked at the properties. So if there's any way we can get that approved, I would like to see us explore that.
We can check with OIP and see what the options are. It would have to be agendized. It'd have to go on the state calendar just the way any other meeting does.
1 month prior.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you'd have to.
7 days. Yeah. 6 days.
Now the realty companies do wonderful jobs at having you see every angle of every property that they're listing. Is there a way for us to have a virtual
virtual tour?
Tour of the properties?
We did that for a while. We had people do tapes when we couldn't make visits during COVID time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bearing in mind that we don't do the nominations and we don't do the presentations, so it would be a matter of what the nominating party is capable and willing to do.
But we didn't we require that for a while, right?
No, we gave them the option, so we had the limited meeting, and they could do an additional presentation. And some of them would take their cell phone or whatever and walk around the property and talk and kind of give us a tour.
That was helpful.
Yeah, but it was up to them.
I think that's more helpful than not having anything.
Agreed. But like you said, that's up to the nominator if they wanted to. And some did that for a little while, and then people stopped making the effort.
By the way, I had a hard time accessing Chandra's link.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the time we did that, she was gone.
Something has been going on. Something has been going on with the state system.
It didn't. I mean, I changed my password. It was a memorized password, you know, automatic password, and it said it didn't recognize it, so I changed it.
And it
still didn't work.
It's not just you guys. I mean, my system took about an hour for it to, up there this morning before the meeting, and it wouldn't let me in for about an hour. We've just had outages. Sometimes there are things that we know about in advance, and then there are other times it just happens, and no one seems to know. At least nobody's willing to explain it to the non-IT folks.
And I couldn't find it on this website for the. You found them under what? Normally I went to resources.
You go to where the agenda is, and it's at the bottom. So you scroll past all the agendas, and there's another one for the documents.
Oh, because at one point it seemed like you could go to resources, and there was a separate line that said nomination.
Yeah, this is you go to the board, and then it says board meeting, the documents, and then you have to scroll down.
Yeah, when Chandra's back in the office, when we're planning to send out the stuff too for the next meeting, we'll try to test it out, like the link more, and make sure that you all have the right link to the website for where you can find it posted there too.
We have, and understand that the format and the process is established for us. We have no control of that.
Sure.
So sorry, to go back to this limited meeting, should we make a motion now to at least potentially see these three? Because if we
I would say yes to that.
Because if we wait until we find out whether we can do a limited one and they say no, then we can't see anything.
The other option might be to delay any additional nominations that we get till the following meeting, so they're on the March agenda and we can approve their site visits for anything that we get in between now and March. We could delay to the meeting after March.
Between now and December 30th.
Or December
30th. Because they have to wait, our timeline starts on 90 days before the meeting. So we would have to have the nomination by the end of December before it to be potentially presented to the board in March.
Okay. So we could do a limited meeting now specifically mentioning these, and then if you get additional properties, we can try to do an updated meeting where we revise the limited meeting motion or something.
The deadline's December 5th.
December 5th?
Okay.
Well, they only have 2 weeks left, and I don't know that we have any additional ones at this point.
So does somebody want to make a motion for the limited meeting to see these two properties?
So move. Do I need to say more?
Well, you have to explain it.
Okay, where's the...
I need to say on which date, which is March 23rd.
I committed myself to more than I wanted to do.
I have a paper in front of me if you want me.
I have it now. So I'd like to propose...
I gave them a cheat sheet.
So I propose that we have a limited meeting for the prior to the March 4th.
So on March 23rd.
On March 23rd, prior to the March 24th. Board meeting, and that this would include the house at Diamond Head Terrace, the Irwin Park, and the Chinatown Historic District.
For reasons of
in the interest of
privacy, safety, and security.
Okay. Second. Thank you.
Who's the second?
Thank you. discussion?
Actually, this time with Irwin Park and Chinatown, it really isn't as so much of an issue.
Yeah. Okay. All in favor? Thank you. The next item is the submitted nominations. Stephanie Torres, Irwin Park, Chinatown, updated. Okay. Any other questions, comments, discussion? Thank you.
Thank you all. Thanks, staff, for all your contributions. This is very, makes it easy for us. Thanks.
Okay, meeting adjourned at, I have 12:08. 12:07,
according to mine.
Oh, you're right. I should have looked at